is Offstage and On the Air Performance 582. I am Lisa Sheps. I am joined by my beautiful and shadow-ridden co-host, Miss Nicole Shiro.
Hello.
You are listening to us on KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby, streaming this live at koop.org. And during the crisis that we're in right now, we are pre-recorded, folks. We will be right back.
Hurry, hurry, step right up. The show's about to begin. Forget your troubles and raise your cup. Step right up. Feast your eyes on the wonders of this world.
Postponed.
Cancelled.
Deprived.
Trapped.
Isolated.
Inside.
But finally, the Michigan Musical Theater Department has...
It's Wednesday, September 16th, 2020. On the show today, we have Texas Performing Arts and Fusebox together. And then later, we'll be talking to New Manifest Theater's Simone Alexander. And this is Membership Drive Light. The first couple weeks, we're just lightly tapping you. So listen to this, and we'll be back after the music.
To get overthrown. Welcome back to school. It's our senior entrance. Time to get to know all you brand new freshmen. Finally, you're home, and your journey's just begun. Get your hands up. Get the campus buzzing. You want it MTs? Well, here's twice a dozen. Let the world know that we're MT20.
We are home brewing this show, and we've pre-recorded it, and you don't know the music that we just played.
I don't know the music. Sometimes we discuss it, but we didn't today.
We didn't this today because I wanted to talk about it. So for our audience and you, we just played the 2021 cast or 2021 senior class of the University of Michigan Theater Department. Every year, the University of Michigan Theater Department does a senior entrance, which is usually it's done live, and it's usually about an hour and a half long, where the seniors get together and they do a song for the other three classes, and specifically to the incoming freshmen of the University of Michigan Theater Company. Have you ever heard of this before?
No, I kind of like it.
I love it. It's all on YouTube and everybody can see it. And this year, as one would expect, it's done virtually. It's not done live. And so we just heard the little opening snippet from it, which of course folks will recognize is from Six, which I like. And I don't know, what was your, I don't think you have as good of opinion of Six as I do.
I'm fascinated by it and I'm enthralled by it, but to me it looks Spice Girls, so I don't get it.
It's kind of Spice Girls-y. Yeah. So anyway, so you can see that whole video, which is 16 minutes long, on our webpage, offstageonair.com.
That's really cool.
What?
That's really cool.
Yeah. So as you know, it is membership drive time right now.
I have to do mine.
Pardon me?
I have to do mine. I normally just run in the room and hand them my card while we're on air, but I have
to go. Well, you know, you might want to, this is membership drive light at this point. We're not doing the big push. There's no telephone number to call. We're just asking people to go to koop.org and
push the button.
Give us money. But I'm going to play something right now. From our friend DJ Harris, who does Overture show tunes on Co-op.
Hi, I'm Mr. Harris, and I'm a longtime Co-op volunteer. And I'm a longtime fan of Lisa Sheps and Nicole Shiro and Offstage and On the Air. All of the programs that you hear on Co-op right now are homecrafted by volunteer programmers. Offstage and On the Air was among the first of co-op's shows to come back on the air. Lisa and Nicole have been nimble and flexible, and they've learned how to make radio for their listeners from their homes. Stand up for Offstage and On the Air right now by donating to Co-op Radio at koop.org. You can use the Safe and Secure Donate Now button, and that will lead you to a place to donate to Co-op Radio and to say something nice about Offstage and On the Air. As a volunteer programmer myself, I know that Lisa and Nicole are putting in more time and working even harder to make great radio. But they stand up every week, and they make home-crafted radio for you. Here's your cue. It's time for you to donate at koop.org. Support community radio in Austin, Texas. Support Lisa and Nicole. Support Cole.
I don't know about that mysterious music we chose.
I was like, I feel like we went to Mars and everything. We were testing stuff out.
It was crazy.
It's our Zoom machine music. He knows we've been getting miles.
That's true. That's right. That was indeed our Zoom machine music. So once again, just go to koop.org. You don't have to live in Austin to support us and give us money.
No, we have supporters outside of Austin and yep. We love them.
All right. We have so much to talk about and we have just zero time to talk about them. But I think I need to talk first about the big theater news that is new from 24 years of a legacy is now over.
Ben Brantley,
a New York Times critic who's been, I did not realize he's the longest running critic since Brooks Atkinson at the New York Times.
I did know that. Isn't that nutty?
I know. And you know what? He looks so young. He's 2 years older than me, which puts him at 64 years old. He looks really young.
He does. I agree.
So he stepped down and he basically said this pandemic is a good opportunity for him to do so. Viscerally speaking, Nicole Shiro, how do you feel about his retirement?
You know what? I kind of could see when he said this was now kind of the perfect time. I could see if this was something you were looking forward to in a different chapter, now is a seamless time. I think he's got something else brewing.
Well, of course he's got something else brewing, but I, you know, he's taken some hits recently, especially around LGBTQ stuff. He did a whole transphobic rant around, oh, I forgot the name of the show, but he's taken a lot of hits from progressive people around the country in theater. When Charles Isherwood unceremoniously was asked to leave the New York Times, the New York Times opted, instead of hiring a woman or a person of color, they opted to bring in Jesse Green, who is another white guy. And I, for one, was not happy about that and held it against Jesse Green for the longest time. I've since warmed to him a little bit, but I was mad that the New York Times did not take the opportunity to add a little bit of diversity to their team. And they have critics that are both women and people of color. So it really sort of angered me. I hope they take the opportunity this time, especially in today's environment, to listen to everybody around them saying, you need a voice that maybe doesn't look like your readers. Mm-hmm. You know, because their readers are typically older, whiter, resourced people.
That's true.
So I'm hoping that they take this opportunity to bring in.
They didn't really say what's happening. They didn't really say if someone's coming in. They alluded to it, but there was nothing set in stone. It was just kind of like, hey, I'm leaving.
I think they have to bring someone in.
I do too. I'm just saying nothing was really addressed.
I kind of hope they would take a cue from what they did when Jesse Green came on board. So instead of seniority, instead of the way it was, which was Ben Brantley was the chief critic and Charles Isherwood was under him, they made Jesse Green a co-critic. So they were equal. And I hope they take that and do that again and put a person of color in that role.
I agree.
Which is something we don't often do.
No. How many other people were reviewers on staff?
They've got like a handful. I don't know that they're on staff. They're probably on staff, but they're usually, you know, there's Alexis Sokolovsky. What's her name? Writes a lot. Elizabeth Vincentelli writes a lot.
Yeah, I see different names.
There's a black man. I can't remember his name. I feel terrible about that. Never grow old, audience. Never grow old. It's not pleasant. It's not good. All right, the last thing I think we have time to talk about, hopefully we have time to talk about it, before our guests come on, is the death of Diana Rigg. Rest in peace.
That was a big one.
Now she, fortunately, she had a resurgence. So she's known from back in the 60s of playing the, oh my God, I forgot the name of the TV series she was in, which she was a replacement
on.
The Avengers. Did you know she was a replacement in the third season?
Isn't that crazy?
She was not the original Emma. I did not know that.
Isn't that, but she's the one that we think of.
She's the one that we think of. She was also in, I forgot which James Bond film, but she was in a James Bond film where she got married.
Yeah, married to Bond.
Yes, oh, which is the only time that's ever happened.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, she's lots of first. And
I love me some James Bond.
Now, she's been on Broadway. I guess, do you know how many times she's been on Broadway?
I'm going to say it was like 9 times, wasn't it?
No, I'm going to say 4 times.
Oh.
She was on Broadway 4 times. Most recently, she played in My Fair Lady next to Lauren Ambrose.
I was like, she's most recently in My Fair Lady, and on the TV, people know her from?
Game of Thrones. She was Lady Tyrell.
Coming.
Yes. So do you remember the dust up during My Fair Lady? We talked about this for a while because I was totally on her side.
Oh, yes.
Lauren Ambrose switched to 6 shows a week.
You didn't like that. And she
no,
was like
she said in my, she said, I'm 100 years old and I'm doing 8 shows a week. And this darn kid is like 12 years old and can't do 8 shows a week. I'm sorry. That's not the way professionals do it. And I so agree with that.
Yeah, that was some pretty good stuff.
I mean, I'm going to repeat what I said before. You know, we had years of theater before microphones and before all this assistance by technology where our performers all performed, stars or no stars, 8 shows a week, and now they don't do it. Stars are commonly 6 shows a week.
You can't argue, well, it's new music like Pasek and Paul. It's not. It's so not. You can't make that argument.
Yeah, so... We agree again. Anyway, the shows that she did in 1971, she did Abelard and Heloise. That was one of my favorite shows.
I don't know that.
I don't either. In 1975, she was in The Misanthrope. And in 1994, she was in Medea. Now I'm not 100% sure about this. I believe she was nominated for a Tony for all of those. And I think she won one. But I don't know
which. I would be surprised. I would love to see her in Medea.
You could go to the library and watch it on film.
I might do that.
Well, so rest in peace, Diana Rigg. She what a life. Very interesting. If you check her Wikipedia page, she had a very interesting life. She will be missed. And I loved her in Game of Thrones. I watched every single episode.
I know you love that Game of Thrones.
I did. So let's introduce our first guests, which I'm so excited about. Texas Performing Arts and Fusebox came together to create a fellowship, which is amazing, and some amazing people. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. So I say, let's just let the story speak for itself.
Let's do it.
Here it is. Well, Nicole, I've done a little work on the Zoom machine. The airlock door was acting up, so we had to replace the airlock.
I noticed the upgrades.
Yep, so that's good. So now we just have to push this little button right here, and it just opens right up. You ready to see who's out there?
I'm excited.
Oh my God, double trouble. We have here in Zoom with us, folks from Texas Performing Arts, Bob Bursey from Texas Performing Arts, And Ron Barry of Fusebox Festival. Hi, you guys.
Hello, everyone.
Hello. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing great. I am thrilled to have you on. Well, imagine my surprise when this press release came across. I had no idea this was happening and was thrilled that it is. So rather than me tell it, why don't one of you tell folks what I'm talking about?
For sure. So Texas Performing Arts and the Fusebox Festival are working together to launch a new commissioning and residency program for Austin performing artists. And what that means is that TPA and Fusebox are creating a structure to put financial resources and stage and studio time and technical and production support directly in the hands of performing artists in our community to create adventurous new projects during this really difficult time for our field.
Yeah, and what a great lineup you have for this year. We did talk about this a few weeks ago when the press release came out. I am very familiar with three of the four people. Of course, we had Charles O. Anderson on along with Robert Ramirez a couple weeks ago, where we talked about his project Recurrent. Ron, what are the other, who else are we featuring here?
Yeah, so Charles Anderson, Rudy Ramirez, Frank Women Collective, and Giselle Mason.
Yeah. I'm not familiar with Rudy Ramirez. Who is he? Teasing, of course.
Living legend. Yeah, we're really thrilled. He's going to be working on this reimagining of these Lorca plays, sort of these body ridiculous comedies that might be able to travel by vehicle. But really excited about Rudy's imagination and his vision and the opportunity to work on that.
Yeah, well, that's great. And then Frank Women Collective, we talked about that. Kelsey Oliver, I do a lot of work with her, and she, I believe, is the head of that. And then Giselle Mason, I love the title of her piece, Yes And.
It is a great name.
Can one of you talk about her piece and what she's doing?
Yeah. Sorry, my dog is going nuts here. One second.
Well, Bob, tell us about Giselle Mason.
Yeah, so Giselle is a really extraordinary choreographer who also happens to be on the faculty here at UT Austin in the dance program. And she has an incredible body of work that she's been putting together over a number of years, where she reconstructs the solos, these very, very important historical modern dance solos created by Black female choreographers throughout the evolution of modern dance as a form. And so that's how I first came in contact with her work. But this particular project is a new piece where she is diving deep into this contemporary moment and reflecting it back to us through her perspective as a Black woman.
That is amazing. So tell us the genesis of this project. How did it all get started?
My work as an arts person relates a lot to supporting the creation of new projects and trying to make space and provide resources for artists to lead the field forward. And it's, as you guys know, it's incredibly difficult in this country, especially for independent artists, to get new work made in a field that is under-resourced overall. Perhaps one of the least resourced areas is the creation of new work by independent contemporary artists. And that's something that Ron and Anna Gallagher-Ross, also at the Fusebox Festival, and I have been talking about since even before I arrived in Austin. And we've had, I think, a shared vision of how we could start to send some resources in that direction and help address that problem. And doing it now is a sort of intersection of the practical opportunity and that very idealistic spirit, right? Because we also at Texas Performing Arts have stages and studios and shops that are not being used in the way that they traditionally would be at this time. So how can we make those available, put them to really good use, and hopefully help artists create some exciting work that we can all share in together when we're able to come back together in the theater again.
Right. So Ron, of course, you know, we're familiar with Fusebox. It does some incredible work in the festival, which happens in the springtime, which of course this year was done virtually. Why Fusebox and this project? What is it that, how does Fusebox meld with UT to make this happen?
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple reasons. I think one, the way that we think about our festival and think about our organization is largely in relationship to others, in relationship to place, and in relationship to other partner sister organizations. It's how we built our organization. The act of putting on a festival to us is an act of community building and sitting across the table from other community members and talking about what would be interesting to do together. And so that's just kind of like a baseline position that we have. And then we've been just huge fans of Bob's for a long time. And when he got this job, we were so excited and started having some conversations, just kind of brainstorming about what are some things that would be interesting to explore together. And this was one of the ideas that came up very early. And I think for a while, and this is echoing a lot of Bob's points too, I think we've just been interested in how we can better support local artists and the field in general, particularly when it comes to the creation of new work. I think all too often that falls squarely on the shoulders of the artists themselves, and they're having to do so much of the heavy lifting. And, you know, I think it's important to have a place to present the work. We don't want to stop presenting finished work. I think that's a vital piece of this process. But I think we were looking to, in addition to that, could we find other opportunities to actually help with the creating of the work? And also, I think our hope for the city is that it is a place where new work can be made and invested in and can really thrive. It's not just a place where you can sort of consume culture, but it's a place where things are made and there's a creative energy around that. And we wanted to invest in that.
I think that's amazing. Of course, Fusebox has been doing that for quite some time. And I love that Texas Performing Arts, which has also had a pretty strong role in creating new works, but we haven't really known about it because it hasn't been out there in the public too much. So I think this is a wonderful marriage, and I'm like so thrilled that y'all are doing it.
Yeah, Lisa and I talked about it, as Lisa mentioned, when we got the press release, we talked about it a lot on the show already. We were very, very excited about this. So thank you.
So this is a one-year pilot project, if I'm reading this correctly. Is there going to be something, will each of these projects have a public showing at the end of the year?
We hope so.
COVID notwithstanding.
Yeah, we're approaching it in a really open-ended and hopefully artist-centered way, which is to say that there is almost nothing that's prescribed about the program. So if it serves the purposes of the work to have a work in progress showing or for us to continue to help develop it, maybe after the residency runs its course or even eventually presented in one context or another, either at TPA or as part of the Fusebox Festival or together in some form, I think we're really open to that. But we've entered into these discussions with the artists we're working with just from the premise of how can we help. And so there are no requirements or even necessarily defined outcomes for the processes at this point.
Wonderful. I tell you that we love the artists you chose, but I'm curious as to what was the process of selecting the artists you chose, and presuming that the program will continue on, if I'm an artist and I want to be considered for next year, what do I do?
Yeah, so we really wanted to, there were a couple factors. I think one, there was the sort of the immediacy of it. Like, we're in this moment, we want to get resources in artists' hand. Like, artists are really struggling right now. We had the space available. We'd never done it before, but we were like, let's make this thing happen. And So we decided in this first iteration, while we're still kind of iterating and imagining it, that we would help identify this initial cohort of artists, and then we would learn from this process with them. We want to take the feedback from the artists, what was helpful, what wasn't, what could we do better, and then launch hopefully an ongoing annual residency program that would also include an open call for local artists, and they could apply and we would make that widely available. But I think for this first iteration, there was a little bit of a sense of urgency, and just because of the moment that we're in and the opportunity. And, you know, we have a long history in this city and with this community, and we chose four artists that we have a history with, that we believe in deeply, whose work we believe in deeply, and who also had projects that we thought would really specifically benefit from this opportunity.
Wonderful. Well, where can folks go if they want to get more information about this program?
I think we both, there's information on both the Texas Performing Arts website and on the Fusebox website. And also follow Fusebox and TPA on Instagram as well. I think that's going to be one of the main platforms where we'll share some of the creative process that's coming out of these residencies.
Wonderful. So that's texasperformingarts.org and fuseboxfestival.org.
Dot com? Yeah.
Well, who knew? I just assume everybody's a .org.
She makes everyone an org.
You're an org.
Yeah.
Well, Bob Bursey and Ron Berry, thank you so much for coming back on Offstage and on the Air. I can't get enough of you guys.
I know.
So anytime you want to come back, you just knock on our door. And by the way, our Zoom machine is available for rental if you want to use it.
Thank you.
We did the upgrades.
Yes. We're constantly upgrading it. We got the new door in last week.
I love it. So good. Well, hey, thank you all so much for having it. This is so nice. It's so lovely to talk with you, and look forward to talking more in the future and give you some updates, and we'll just keep you posted.
Great. Thanks. Bye. And thanks for all the work you guys are doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for your support.
That, Bob Bursey and Ron Berry, love them, love what they're doing.
You know, you're going to have to package all these up after 2020 and call them the Zoom Chronicles.
The Zronicles. The Chronozooms.
Travels.
Well, anyway, we have to take a little break and we'll be right back. We are back. You're listening to Offstage and on the Air with Lisa and Nicole. Lisa and Nicole. It is close to membership drive. Go to koop.org. Give us some money, would you please? Thank you.
Donate, push the little button, Lisa and Nicole.
You sent me a great article of national import about theater from the New York Times. It's called How to Birth a New American Theater. This is an article written by the Times, and it's actually five of their critics: Jesse Green, Maya Phillips, Laura Collins Hughes, Elizabeth Vincentelli, and Alexis Soloski, which
they're the names we were looking for.
They're the names about what theater could look like after COVID-19. Mm-hmm. Which we don't have time to get into this, but the other thing you sent me, which is which a lot of people have been talking about, is Anthony Fauci basically said that theater will not come back to normal, and by normal, full seats, no masks, till the end of 2021. That doesn't discount something else, but that was kind of heartening. But these five critics looking back at what we've learned during this crisis and how theater can change itself to make itself better.
They're fascinating reads in the last.
They're fascinating, and I agree with most of them, with the exception of like one or two. But a lot of it talked about especially Maya Phillips talked about, you know, theater needs to open up their canon of work to classic and new works by African American playwrights and other playwrights of color. And that's got to be big. Going along with that, that I think goes hand in hand with that. And it was, I believe, hold on, I got to get to the page. Laura Collins Hughes says it needs to be affordable. So we got to find some way to make theater affordable. She said the headline was theater must be affordable to essential workers. Mm-hmm. So we have all this theater, we have this great theater, and we have to find a way to make it affordable. There is no reason in the world why a theater ticket should cost $400. And that's the face value, with scalpers charging over $1,000 for a theater ticket. I it's criminal.
I agree with you on that.
Yeah. But what really angers me, and I think I'm really the only one that talks about this, so I'm going to give myself credit for it, is the one of the shows that talks about this a lot is Hamilton. And they single-handedly caused the current problem with premium ticket pricing.
I know.
So I just had this idea while I was reading this article, is what if every show, I'm talking about commercial theater, held, 5% of their audience, scattered throughout, orchestra, loge, everywhere, like $25 tickets that weren't predicated on any kind of anything, that you could just get them somehow.
Well, that's what
for
some of
every
the Rush
performance.
People are, but that's what some of the Rush people did from when Rush first created. Then they even took an extra chunk out.
Yeah.
Do
I'm
that.
Not talking about Rush. I'm talking about something else. I don't know how it would be done, but it would be, I could buy a ticket in advance.
I know you're not talking about Rush, but what I'm saying is when Rush first started, it was this thing is Rush, but now that's what they've done and they've kind of blended the two.
Yeah, I know. So my little idea is something a little different than that. But yes, people are trying to do it, but they're not doing a good job. It's still a medium for rich people. Jesse Green, and this is the one I kind of disagree with, but I agree with at the same time. He says we have to embrace streaming to grow audiences. Well, he's arguing, and I don't 100% agree. We all talk about how, or I talk about how theater is about sitting shoulder to shoulder in the audience with people. And I think that's really important. Streaming has added a lot of accessibility that we didn't have. And I applaud that. And I think it should continue. I don't know if we call it theater or not, but I did air quotes because nobody can see that. So I don't know.
I don't think it's a replacement. I just think it's a supplement and another thing. I mean, it's to me, the streaming theater is like me going on Twitter or on social media or YouTube and finding people doing songs and finding extra bits.
And
it's that same obsession to me.
Right.
It doesn't replace theater for me.
Right. I love how it's become accessible. We see things that we can't see. For instance, you watched last night, Miscast, which is usually done live in New York, and you would not see it.
So what was really interesting is they had two YouTube channels, a regular and a closed caption, and I went on both of them. And the comments that everybody wrote was, I totally would still come to this in person, but you need to put this online and do this live every year too.
Yeah.
It was nonstop in the comments.
I think what we've learned from Hamilton is that streaming these shows does not cannibalize their ticket sales. Mm-hmm. And we've learned that. And that leads me to the last thing that Elizabeth Vincentelli said. Her headline is theater profits must be redistributed. Now I love this idea. And I did not realize, you probably did, that sports leagues have been doing this for years.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is that a certain amount of profit is redistributed to smaller, less resourced theaters. That they take a certain amount of their money and they give it away. And I think that that's amazing. I think that's
amazing.
It's so
funny because the sports are a hot mess and they're not my favorite thing and they have so many problems, but it's actually one thing they got right.
And the last thing is that...
The last thing is you're awesome.
Yes. I don't know about this one either. This is Alexis Solosky, who wrote that theater etiquette needs to be relaxed. And I agree to a point, but I disagree to a point as well.
That one I kind of was like, you know, I don't want people showing up.
She makes a good point. She makes a good point that there are things that if you're engaged with the piece and that comes out vocally, then that may be okay. Wearing flip-flops to the theater doesn't change anybody else's experience to the theater, really. But, and she points it out, which I think is funny, walking up on stage to plug your telephone into the outlet on the theater set is probably not a good thing to do.
Like Hand of God?
So we have some local stuff that I need to talk about, but we're gonna talk about that after our next interview.
Okay.
We talked to Simone Alexander, who is the creator and artistic director of New Manifest Theater, about their theater festival, their second year. This year, obviously, is done online. And Simone, New Manifest Theater is in its second year, and she's really making a name for herself.
I love her.
So let's hop on into the Zoom machine and talk to her.
Let's do it up.
All right, it's getting a little cramped here inside the Zoom machine because I've been eating too much.
Well, you did bring good snacks in this last ride, so I'm okay with that.
I did. It's those super hot Cheetos. They get messy when we're in zero gravity. All that Cheeto dust flies around.
It's okay.
All right. Well, let's open the door and see who we find, shall we?
Yes.
Well, it's New Manifest Theater Company's Simone Alexander. Hi, Simone.
Hi, Simone.
Hi. Hi, great to be here.
Welcome back to Offstage and On the Air. First of all, I have to say I'm really jealous. I think Simone is such a great name. I want it.
It is a good name.
I mean, I will say growing up, I constantly got Simon. So it was always like nobody had ever heard the name before. And I didn't even think it was that special, to be honest, because I've met like a handful of Simones in my lifetime. But so many people are like, what is that name? Is it Simon? And I'm like, no, it's not.
That is so strange. I would have never thought.
Me neither. It is a great name.
It is a great name. And so I'm thinking it because I think Simone Sheps would be real good because it's got that alliteration thing going.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. So you could be Lisa Alexander. It works. We'll switch.
So true. So true.
So New Manifest Theater, relatively new theater company, and you are having your second annual Playfest. Hold on. I'm going to tell you the name of it. The Manifest Mini Fest. Is that right?
Yeah, we're in our second year. So it's very interesting. We had already planned it the first time to be a continuous annual festival. So for the second time to be a virtual festival, it's definitely been a pivot, but we're excited about it.
Well, so let's just talk about the festival in general. It's a short play festival. This is the second year, and of course this year will be done virtually. What are the requirements to be included in the festival?
So really, we leave it pretty broad. Other than being a short play, we ask for it to be, 15 minutes or less. But honestly, we get some stuff that are 20 to 30 minutes that we'll definitely read. And if we have room for it, we'll make room for it. But really, we try to gain a wide variety of not only genres, but storytelling to really build the event as a diversity of not only storytelling, genre, and voices, but also the actors involved in the creative team as well.
Great. Well, I noticed last year you had a company of actors that I guess did all of the plays. So is that going to be the same situation this year? Is it the same group of actors doing all of the plays?
It is not the same group of actors. We do have our ensemble members who are a part of the festival. We try to have our ensemble members be a part of almost everything that we do, just leaving the door open for if they have availability for it and are interested in the work, then we'll make room. So this time we have our ensemble members as directors as well as actors and in our workshops that we're doing.
Wonderful. So how long ago did you choose the plays for this season?
So we put out the call for plays, I want to say at the beginning of the year, and we had a deadline of April 30th. Last year, we actually had a total of, I think, 35 submissions, and we ended up having to extend the deadline. But this time, we had 70 submissions, so we did not extend the deadline because that was enough for our literary committee to read through and try to whittle down to something realistic that we felt we could put a lot of effort behind for this.
And so how many did you end up for this year that are
finally 70.
No, how many will be shown?
We'll have four.
Four. Great. So tell us about those pieces.
Yeah. So a lot of these playwrights are local. We do have some that are from Chicago as well. But we have Boy by Chris Eli Black. He's a playwright, I think, from the Houston area. And then we have another play called Flat Hens Don't Lay Eggs or How the Chicken Crossed the Road by Katie Svatek. She's also from the Texas State area. I believe she's still at school at Texas State University too.
Actually, she says she holds a BFA from Texas State University.
Oh, just graduated.
There you go.
Just graduated, yeah. And then we have Covenant by Christiana Ray Colon, who we worked with
on your last
earlier
week,
this
right?
year. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for Good Friday. And then we have Maud by Andra Hunter, and she's in Dallas.
Awesome. Sounds like fun. And these are going to be done on Zoom. And, you know, we've kind of come accustomed to Zoom pieces in a lot of different, I mean, they go from just a reading to a little bit more produced. Where are you on that continuum with these pieces?
So we're actually not streaming them through Zoom. We are doing the festival in sort of a Zoom platform, but we're actually using the platform StreamYard, which I've seen more for conferences. Mm-hmm. So really all four of these pieces will be recorded and edited prior to the actual festival and then streamed during the festival.
Okay. And I must say to you and my listeners, I use Zoom in the generic sense, like Kleenex. Yes, many more people are doing StreamYard. As a matter of fact, I'm going to be doing a piece tonight that's using StreamYard.
Oh. I've seen it pop up a lot lately.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can do a little bit more with it. You can like do switching, and it's really good for live. So, but for something that you're going to edit, it could almost be any platform in that case.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, so that's wonderful. So you're probably right now, we are recording this in the end of August. So almost a month before the actual festival. So I'm guessing you are in the midst of performing and editing right at this very moment.
Correct. So we really spent a lot of time getting, the resources to all of our cast members so that they could film remotely from their homes. And then we're editing it all together and working with our sound designer, Melissa Quiles, to have a little pre-post show music as well that people can explore and, be hopefully entertained by.
Wonderful. And now you also, this year is a little different from last year in that you're offering workshops.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah.
Tell us about those.
We really thought it was important, in the new manifest mission to begin with, our vision is really to not only support our ensemble, but also create a support system of artists in general. And I feel like offering these workshops are really helpful, especially at this time where we're all on hold. And I think a lot of people are benefiting from this time of being able to be in a little bit of an artist incubator, learning and taking advantage of these educational opportunities when they come about. And especially since we're all home, it was almost a benefit to get some of these panelists who I really don't think we would have been able to get because we would have to, fly them all to Austin and physically have it here. So I think I'm really excited about our playwriting workshop because it does highlight the playwrights we have worked with in our first and second season. Idris Goodwin, who did our inaugural show, The Realness, a breakbeat play. And then Christiana Ray Colon, who did Good Friday, also The Covenant, that'll be in Minifest. But I really loved them because I like their work. They're both artist activists and educators who really have that intertwined both in their community practices as well as their artistry. And funny enough, when I had first met Christiana, she had asked me how I knew of Idris, and she told me that Idris was one of her very first mentors and examples of a real life playwright making money and pursuing a career. So I just thought it was amazing that we could get them together, kind of reminisce about their mentorship, but also what they're doing as working playwrights at this time. And then I'm also super, super excited about our early career producing workshop with Yvonne Edebury from the Parsnip Ship podcast. She does great work in New York producing new work and highlighting those artists. I had actually heard of her the first time because she did a Taji Senior's play maybe a year ago or early last year. Mm-hmm. But I saw that podcast and I was just so enthralled, and she does such great work. But then also Rudy Ramirez will be there talking about their work on Future X Festival and also their work within the Austin community. And I think Rudy is such a staple in Austin. So that'll be really great to get their insight.
How long are the workshops? Like, what's the length on the workshop?
So they'll be about an hour long. That's including, the panelists talking about their career, as well as a Q&A section.
Great. Well, we are just about out of time. Tell us when and how people can see this festival and participate in the workshops.
Yeah, totally. So we will be pushing out information of registration for the workshops. We'll begin September 1st. And then the festival will be September 24th, that's a Thursday, through Saturday, September 26th.
Great. And what website should folks go to see more information?
Newmanifest.org.
Awesome. And I know I just need to, before we go away, I just want to mention that New Manifest has a podcast that is just wonderful. The latest one is with India Wilmot, who I just love, love, love. And I'm so, you're quite prolific with your podcast. It looks like you do about one a week.
Yeah, we're trying. Right now it's actually been highlighting Black artists in Austin. There are so many of them, and just getting them a chance and a platform to talk about their work has been really great. And now we're kind of pivoting to also highlight our Minifest playwrights. So that'll be our next few
awesome. Well, that's
podcasts
such
leading up to the festival.
Right. I feel that's such important work, especially in our current atmosphere. So I'm glad you're doing it. So Simone Alexander, thank you so much for joining us here on Offstage and on the Air.
Yes. Thank you for coming today, Nicole.
Thank you, Lisa. It's great talking to y'all.
It was good talking to you too.
Guys, answer everyone.
There it is. I love Simone Alexander.
She has a smile that's infectious.
She really does.
She does.
We're going to take a little break and play a song from If Then. If Then was a vehicle for Idina Menzel, directed by Michael Greif. It had a developmental lab in 2013 in D.C. and opened on Broadway in March of 2014, pre-coronavirus. We talk about a lot of things that are pre-coronavirus. Anyway, it didn't do really, really well. It ran for 400 performances on Broadway and then went on the road. And it did okay as long as Idina Menzel was continuing as the star. We're going to play a song from that show called It's a Sign. It's sung by LaChanze, who I used to call LaChance, but it's LaChanze. And, let's just enjoy that song.
Yesterday, this woman met this man in Madison Park, quite by chance.
Lovely song by LaChanze. Other people in the show were Tamika, Sonia Lawrence, Jen Colella, who people will know from Come From Away, Jerry Dixon, Jason Tam, and Anthony Rapp. So quite a great cast. We have a couple of local things that are very important for us to talk about. First of all, we don't have a lot of time to talk about it because there's just too much stuff happened this week. But Frontera Fest 2021 has been canceled completely.
So, I know.
That's both the Short Fringe, the Long Fringe, Mi Casa Es Tu Teatro. All that has been canceled for 2021.
I'm making a sad face right now on the little screen. Yeah.
It's really sad. So now would be the time to go to HydeParkTheater.org or ScriptWorks.org and just look and support them in any way you can.
Good call.
The other big deal is in this, I did not read this article. I really just reacting to the headline. The North Door closed.
Say it again?
The North Door closed.
When did that happen?
I just saw the
City Comedy Club, but I didn't know the North Door.
What was the one that you just said?
Cap City Comedy Club.
Cap City Comedy Club closed? Did not know. Well, a nodding doesn't work on radio. So Cap City Comedy closed?
Yeah. Yes. But I didn't know about North Door.
It was in Jean Claire Van Ryzen's Sightlines yesterday.
And I read yesterday. I don't know how I missed it.
So that's going to be tough for a lot of people doing, because that was the home for a lot of people doing some innovative stand-up work. And they had deals where it didn't cost the producers a lot of money to perform there because the North Door is a for-profit company that was open to make money selling drinks and things like that and cover charge. So that's really sad.
Yeah, that's a lot. Those are some big hits to venues right now this week.
Really big hits. So I hate to leave things on a downer note.
I'll jazz hand.
We'll jazz hand it. And so that's it. So we're going to call that a day. Another real quick, the prom movie set a date for its opening.
That.
I did not know it had Nicole Kidman in it.
Yeah, I saw that too. And I was like, why Ryan Murphy?
Well, see, this is where you and I differ. I actually like Nicole Kidman. So we'll see how it turns out.
I don't have a problem with her. I have a problem with her singing.
Yeah, but I think she's playing the role of it's not a major singing role.
Major singing role. Yeah.
Anyway, so that's it for today. And we will be back next week when we look at what's happening off stage and on the air. Goodbye. Go to koop.org. And remember, hashtag ATX Theater.
Yes. Hashtag.
My father thanks you. My mother thanks you. My sister thanks you. And I thank you.